Well, good morning, everybody. It's great to see you today, and it's good to be back from Philadelphia. I was part of the team that went. I went last Sunday after church, and we got back on Thursday evening. You know, a couple of things I was reminded of while I was there is this: God is at work everywhere. We often kind of get a little microscopic in our view of life, living in our own world, in our own workplace, in our small town, and it's great to get out of here once in a while and to see that no matter how bad things get, God is always at work. And it's great for us to get out of our normal place and normal schedules and get out of town to see what God is doing. So let me encourage you to jump onto one of these mission trips that we're taking, either here in our own community. You know, we have an opportunity to go just across the street once a month to minister to the folks in the home there on a Sunday afternoon. A Saturday morning, there's a team that goes door to door in the Auburn Greens. And you can go just across the street around the world, but let me encourage you to do that. The second thing that I noticed and the second thing that I brought back was, you know, it's so important for us to see people that aren't seen. To notice people that are unnoticed. In every community, there are people that are unseen. There are people that go unnoticed and kind of push to the side a little bit. And we have those folks in our own town. And we as followers of Christ need to reach out and to love on those folks. And so I'm excited about what God might be doing in the future here as giving us an opportunity to see the folks that aren't seen and to notice those that are unnoticed. So it's a great time. It was a great trip. So I want to encourage you to jump on one of those. Also, I got a message this morning. Guys, you know, one of the most important things we do every year is play softball. And so the softball team is starting. One of our managers, our coach, went to this meeting yesterday, and it actually starts this Thursday night. So luckily it's going to rain us out, and so we don't have to start on Thursday. But if you have been interested in the men's softball team, Jim Robinson's going to be out in the courtyard today, and he can sign you up. If you haven't signed up, he'll give you a schedule if you have, and you'll be hearing more about that in times to come. All right, well, we're going to continue this morning. We're galloping through the last couple of chapters of the book of Acts. And we're going to continue to see some exciting things there. So we're in chapter 25 today, Acts chapter 25. And we're going to be looking at a big section of scripture, the whole chapter today, because it's hard for me to break it down into different groups, into different ideas, when it's just a great story that's flowing through. If you've just been joining us, you know, my voice sounds a little weird, doesn't it, today? Sounds weird in my own head. I've been having a cold lately, so it's not you, Jeremy. It's not the sound guy. It's just me. It's me. But we've been going through the life of Paul, and we've been learning about how we should live, and as we engage our culture, as we go through the different circumstances of our life. And we've been looking at Paul, and we're in the middle of these five defenses, I'm calling them. You know, when people were to, if someone was to ask you, why do you follow Jesus? What would your answer be? Not just from your experiences, but also what is the truth behind Jesus that you follow? So when you're able to tell your story, when I'm able to tell my story, and when I've been able to tell the truth about Jesus behind the story, I'm in a sense giving my defense, giving my story as to why I'm a follower of Jesus. In these last couple of chapters, and in this chapter, and in the next chapter, Paul is giving a series of five defenses. We saw how he gave one to the crowd that was in the courtyard. Remember, the Jewish people grabbed Paul out of the temple, and he asked if he could talk to them for a few minutes. And he gave his story to them. He told them why he was a follower of Jesus. We saw it before the council of the Sanhedrin, when he was dragged into their council chamber and asked to give a defense as to why he was a follower of Jesus. We saw last week that he gave his defense before the governor Felix. Today we're going to look at how he gives this defense before another governor who replaces Felix, and his name is Festus. These names are so funny to me. It brings back all these childhood stories, right? Felix the... Okay, you know, and Festus, that guy, wasn't it on Gunsmoke or whatever? Okay. You know, when I pulled up some images on the internet today, I said, Governor Festus, and his picture from Gunsmoke pulled up. Today, we're going to be talking about how he gives his defense before Festus. And then next week, we're going to look how he gives his defense before King Agrippa. Five defenses. If someone were to ask you at work, why in the world do you follow Jesus? Could you tell them why? Could you share your faith story? And then they asked you, well, what is Christianity all about? Could you share the truth behind your faith? That's your defense. Peter tells us to always be ready, right? 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. Always be ready to give an answer, or it's the same word, defense, as to why we follow Jesus. It's been fun to hear. About 4 or 5 weeks ago, I did a sermon on how to share your faith story and how to write your faith story. And some of you have shared those with me, and it's been a great experience. Let me encourage you, write down why you follow Jesus so that when the opportunity presents itself, you can share your defense. Paul calls them a defense. It's simply an answer as to why I follow Jesus. Now, this morning, we're going to get just a little bit into the history. I love the history of the context here. And here's a map of Israel. And during this time, here is Jerusalem down here. And here is some Caesarea up here. This is where Paul is right now. Remember, they brought him from Jerusalem around this way. And now he's had one trial with Felix up there last week. And today, he's still in Caesarea. It's 2 years later. And he's now on trial again with Festus. But this whole region, you can see this is the region of Judea. And so the governor, whoever was the Roman governor, was the governor of all of this area, the governor of Judea. Felix was the governor, now Festus is the governor, and then later on another guy becomes governor, but Paul's already gone by that time. So Governor Felix, we saw last week, Governor Festus is what we're looking at today. But there's always been a history of a tug of war between the Jewish leadership, between the Orthodox Jews in Jerusalem, and the governor that Rome has put in place. We see historically there's been this tug of war of who's going to really have control of the area of Judea. Is it going to be the Roman governor, or is it going to be the Sanhedrin, the religious leaders in Jerusalem? And we find all the way back to Pontius Pilate that there is this tug of war. You know, when Pontius Pilate was appointed as governor to the area of Judea, he wanted to set Roman rule down harshly. So one of his first deeds as governor is he rolled into Jerusalem with his army. And covering their armaments, covering their chariots, were the pictures of their gods, because the Romans believed in a lot of gods, and they believed that their gods gave them victory in battle. And so on their shields and on their chariots and on their armament, they had these pictures of their Roman gods. And when they came into Jerusalem, the Jews went crazy, because the second commandment is what? Thou shalt have no other, no, that's number one. You shall know of the gods before me. Number two is, you shall have no graven images of other gods. So when Pontius Pilate rolled into Jerusalem with all these graven images, and he started hanging up replicas of Caesar all over Jerusalem, the Jews went crazy. And they rebelled, and they actually sent a little detachment to Rome, and they asked Rome to tell Pontius Pilate to take down all of the images in Jerusalem. And Rome sent a letter to Pontius Pilate and told him to take all the images down. And so there's this tug of war taking place. In fact, when Jesus shows up on the scene and Pontius Pilate puts Jesus on trial, Pontius Pilate comes out to the Jewish leaders and he says, I find no fault in him. There's nothing that this guy has done that's deserving of anything that you want to do to him. And way back in the book of John, John chapter 19 and verse 12, you can see how the Jewish leadership puts pressure on Pontius Pilate. And look what they say in John chapter 19 and verse 12. Pontius Pilate wants to let Jesus go, but the Jewish people don't. And it says in 19 verse 12, as a result of this, Pilate made efforts to release Jesus, but the Jews kept crying out, saying, if you release this man, you are no friend of who? Caesar's. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar. You know what the Jews are doing? They're putting pressure on Pilate. If you don't crucify Jesus, we're going to go back to Rome and we're going to tell them you are no friend of Caesar's. So there's this tug of war. Then Pontius Pilate is replaced by Felix. And we saw that Felix was a procrastinator. Felix was a bad leader because he was indecisive. And he kept Paul in prison for 2 years, even though he was a Roman citizen. And there were riots breaking out all over the place in his region of control. And so finally in 59 AD, Rome recalled Felix back. And if you go now to Acts chapter 24, the last two verses of Acts chapter 24 tell us a little bit about Felix. He liked to have bribes given to him. Verse 26, it says, at the same time too, Felix was hoping that money would be given to him by Paul, therefore used to send for him quite often and converse with him. And then verse 27, after 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and wishing to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul imprisoned. 59 AD, Felix gets recalled back to Rome because he has been a terrible leader in this region, and the Jewish leadership have been able to manipulate him over and over and over again. In fact, they got Felix to keep Paul, a Roman citizen, in prison for 2 years, even though Felix could not come up with a charge that was worthy of imprisonment. So he was recalled. Now, in chapter 24, verse 27, we see that Felix is replaced by Festus. Now, Festus was told to get things in order. The whole region was in chaos. There was a lot of hostility between the Jewish people and the Roman government. And so Festus was given the charge by Rome, go down there to Judea and get everything in order and set things straight and settle the issues and stop the hostility. And so they pick a guy, Festus, who's a decisive leader. But Festus was what we would call a pragmatic. He did what was best for him. And we're going to see in some of the decisions that he makes today that he makes decisions that are best for him. He only lasts for 2 years and then he dies while he's in leadership in this area. But we're in chapter 25. Let's jump right in. Excuse me. Chapter 25, the newest legal game heats up. You know what we're going to find this morning? I'll just tell you where we're going. We're going to find that just because you live a godly life, just because you're right, just because you're noble, doesn't guarantee justice, does it? It doesn't mean that everything is going to turn out okay all the time. Paul has been in prison for 2 years, and we're going to find there are four guys that could have set him free, and none of the four set him free. Although they could not have any, they couldn't find a single charge to stick, they wouldn't let him go. Sometimes your relationships are going to fall apart. Sometimes my relationships are going to fall apart, not because of anything wrong that you have done or that I have done. Sometimes people are going to mistreat us. Sometimes justice is not going to be served. But we still have hope in God and hope in Christ. But in this world, we're not always going to find justice even when we're right or even when we live godly. Because a lot of times what happens in your life, what happens in my life, is a result of someone else's choices, not simply my own personal choices. And so we have to learn how to walk through graciously, how to live godly in spite of injustices being done to us or to our families or to our businesses or to our neighborhoods. Let's see what happens. Number one, the newest legal battle heats up. Let's go to chapter 25 and let's start there and let's read verses 1 through 5. Festus then, having arrived in the province, 3 days later, went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. Okay, so the first thing that we find out about Festus is that he's a man of action. He comes into Caesarea, that was the Roman headquarters. He's new in town. He's trying to assess what's taking place. What issues does he need to deal with? And he realizes right away he's got to get up to Jerusalem because that's where the center of the hostility is. So you'll notice here, he's only in his new town. He's only in his new palace for 3 days, and then he goes down to Jerusalem. He wants a speedy resolution. It says there in verse 2, and the chief priests and the leading men of the Jews brought charges against Paul, and they were urging him, requesting a concession against Paul, that he might be brought down to Jerusalem, at the same time setting an ambush to kill him on the way. And so we find that the Jews wanted an advantage, and they wanted an ambush. Remember, Paul had been tried in Jerusalem once in front of the Sanhedrin, and that resulted in chaos. In fact, if we went back and read that episode again, we would be reminded that the commander Lysias ran into that council meeting and grabbed Paul because he feared that Paul would be torn limb from limb. It was not a good experience. And then Paul was rushed up to Caesarea, and now the Jews are asking that Paul be brought back down to Jerusalem. And just like before, they want to plot to kill him. But Festus is wise. Look at verse 4. Festus then answered that Paul was being kept in custody in Caesarea, and that he himself was about to leave shortly. Therefore, he said, let the influential men among you go there with me, and if anything is wrong about the man, let them prosecute him. He says, no, I'm not going to bring Paul down here. I know your schemes. Paul's going to remain in Caesarea, but you guys can come back up to Caesarea, and you can make charges against him there. So the new legal game begins to heat up. So it says in verse 6 that he spent not more than 8 or 10 days among them, and then he went back down to Caesarea. And the next day took his seat on the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. Now you'll notice there it says 8 to 10 days. So Festus stayed in Jerusalem 8 to 10 days. That was plenty of time for the Jewish leadership to get their case together and then to go back up to Caesarea and put Paul on trial again a second time, 2 years after his trial with Felix. And then you'll also notice when Festus went back up to Caesarea, it says there that the next day he took his seat on the tribunal. Now the tribunal is just hit the court system. It's like the judge's bench. When Festus sits in the tribunal, he represents the power of Rome. He represents Caesar. And so he can adjudicate this situation with the full power of the Roman government behind him. He can finally put this issue with Paul to rest. Because remember, Festus inherited 2 big problems from Felix. The whole territory was in political chaos, and there was this problem prisoner that the Jewish people still tried to get rid of. And so the first thing that Festus does is he wants to get rid of this problem prisoner. And so it says he went down to Jerusalem, and he says, come on up to Caesarea. Festus goes back up to Caesarea the very next day, sits on the tribunal seat, now has the authority of Rome. He's going to settle this issue once and for all. He's going to settle it once and for all. Verse 7, after Paul arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him, which they could not what? They couldn't prove it. Once again, in the third defense that Paul makes, nobody can prove the charges. There's not a witness that says that he was rebelling against the Roman government. There wasn't one affidavit that supported him being a rebel against the temple or against the Jewish people. Remember, the charges against Paul was that he was a pest, that he was spreading bad stuff. Charge number 2 is that he was stirring up dissension. Charge number 3 is that he was the ringleader of a sect. And charge number 4 was that he had defiled the temple. So here we are 2 years later, and they still can't prove the charges. And all they needed to prove the charges was have 2 or 3 witnesses to stand up and to testify. So they could not prove. Verse 8, while Paul said in his own defense, I have committed no offense either against the law of the Jews, that's the accusation of the ringleader of the sect, the law of the Jews, against the temple, or against Caesar. But one of the things we always find here is that these Roman leaders are more concerned about favor than justice. They are more concerned about people liking them and getting along with them than they are concerned about doing what is right and what is just. Boy, does that sound like our political culture today? Are people more concerned about personal favor than they are about doing what's right? I think we see that all over the place. I think we can see that in business, that we can see that in education, we can see that in our political arena, we can see it in Christian institutions, we can see it in churches, we can see it in pastors sometimes, if we're not confident. Amen. Okay? Now, why was that the only one that got an amen there? We have to be careful because the human heart always seeks personal favor over doing what's right. It's a strong temptation. And we see in verse 9, but Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me on these charges? Now remember, Paul has been in Caesarea for 2 years. He's been waiting to be released. No charges have been brought against him that have stuck. And now what Festus wants to do in order to gain favor from the Jews is take Paul back down to Jerusalem and set him before the same group that Paul had been in front of before. Are you willing to go down there? But then he assures him that I will go and I will watch over the proceedings to make sure that they're done right. And Paul is saying, what? Go back to the council? Festus wanted Paul's trial to go back into Jerusalem to make a show of it and to give Paul over to them. But Paul knows Festus is not going to treat him fairly or protect him. So look at verse 10. Verse 10, Paul says, I am standing before Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried. I have done no wrong to all the Jews, as you also very well know. There are no provable charges here. And he goes on to say in verse 11, if then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I don't refuse to die. But if none of these things are true by which these men accuse me, no one can hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar. Paul, again, stands up for his personal rights. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. As a citizen of Rome, just because he was a follower of Jesus doesn't make him a weak citizen. Sometimes I think in our culture today, if we think that we want to be a strong Christian, we have to be a weak citizen. And I don't see that anywhere in the Bible. I think if you, as a citizen of this great country, are having your personal rights violated in any way, we should stand up and we should make sure that our personal rights are being cared for. Now, every country is different. Our country happens to have a multitude of personal rights and personal freedoms, but just because I'm a follower of Jesus doesn't mean I give up any of those rights. In fact, I think our founding fathers thought that our current form of government would help us amplify those rights. And so Paul says, I'm not going to let you put me in that trap. I appeal to Caesar. Now, this was a crazy thing to do because do you know who Caesar was at this time? It was Nero. Do you remember the name Nero? Nero was a crazy man. Nero killed most of his family because whenever he felt threatened by somebody, he didn't just go have a face-to-face conversation with them. He just took them to the guillotine. And in fact, about this time, during the sixth year of Nero's reign, Rome came out with a new policy that the emperors should now be worshipped as a god and included in the group of gods that the Romans worshipped. So the idea of emperor worship was now coming into full force But Paul says, I would rather put myself under that guy than to go back to Jerusalem. It's a pretty bold statement. So he stands up for his personal rights. And then in verse 12, then when Festus had conferred with his council, he answered, you have appealed to Caesar, to Caesar you shall go. Now, Festus was glad about this decision because it got Paul out of town. It told the Jews that he was handling the case. What the Jews really wanted was Paul dead. The next best thing was to get him completely out of the territory and to send him to Rome. So Festus, being a very pragmatic person, what was best for him, he could find favor with the Jews because he handled Paul and got him out of the area, and he could be okay with Paul because he wasn't going to unjustly put him to death or allow him to be put to death. So he came up with a great solution. This is awesome. If you want to go to Rome, I'm going to send you to Rome. And he says, to Caesar, you will go. To Caesar, you will go. And that's the end of the trial. Now, verse 13, down through the rest of the chapter, Festus presents his case to King Agrippa. This is so great. Look at verse 13. When several days had elapsed, King Agrippa and Bernice, we'll talk about her next week, arrived at Caesarea and paid their respects to Festus. And while they were spending many days there, Festus laid out Paul's case before the king, saying, There is a man who was left as a prisoner by Felix. And you'll notice again, just like Felix did, he's going to throw his predecessor under the bus. There was a man who was left as a prisoner by Felix. And when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews brought charges against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation against him. I answered them that it is not the custom of the Romans to hand any one man over before the accused meets his accusers face to face and has an opportunity to make a defense against the charges. So that after they had assembled here, I did not delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought before me. When the accusers stood up, they began bringing charges against him. Not of any such crimes as I was expecting, but they simply had some points of disagreement with him about their own religion and about a dead man named Jesus, who Paul asserted is alive. Being at a loss of how to investigate such matters, I asked whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and to stand trial on these matters. But when Paul appealed to be held in the custody of the emperor's decision, I ordered him to be kept in custody until I sent him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I would like to hear this man myself. Tomorrow, he said, you shall hear him. So King Agrippa wants to hear Paul's case. Look at verse 23. So on the next day, Agrippa came together with Bernice amid great pomp and circumstance and entered the auditorium accompanied by the commanders and the prominent men of the city. So you'll notice who's there. Festus, King Agrippa, Bernice, the commanders, and the prominent men of the city. Now, it says they came into the auditorium. A picture on the screen here. This is the auditorium. A couple of years ago, our church took a group to Israel, and we went to Caesarea, and we went to the auditorium where Paul stood in front of Agrippa and Festus. Now, you have to picture the auditorium. You can see, obviously, this is like a theater. You have to imagine in your mind's eye the back where you see where the stage is there in the back, that all of this would have been covered by wood, frame, and cloth. This would have been the back part of the theater, and it would have been covered by poles and cloth. All of that is gone. But here is the stage where Agrippa and Bernice and Festus would have actually been seated. And Paul would have been standing somewhere down here giving his defense. It's pretty crazy to actually be standing there and to be thinking that you could be standing about where Paul stood when he was brought into this auditorium. You'll also notice here, we uncovered this first century backpack. Now, what I want to show you here is the dark stones. These stones here came later, but these cracked gray stones that you see were original stones on the floor of first century Paul. So you could literally be standing on the stones where Paul was standing when he gave his defense to Agrippa and to Festus. Now, next January, we're taking another team from our church back. So if you'd like to go on a tour of Israel, okay, January of 2017, we're going to go back to Caesarea, among other places, and we're going to see incredible sights like that. In fact, right outside of this auditorium, they found a big stone, and it has Pontius Pilate's name on it. And it's the only reference outside of Jerusalem proving that Pontius Pilate was there about this time. Another evidence that the stories of the Bible are true. So it costs about $3,500, go for about 10 days. January of 2017, you can see this. But it's an incredible feeling to stand there and to think, wow, this is where Festus and Paul and King Agrippa and Bernice and all these folks stood. So Paul, Festus summarizes it. He wants to hear Agrippa. And then Festus gives an opening statement. Let's go down to verse 24 and we'll wrap up the chapter with this. So they're all coming to the auditorium. In verse 23, it says they come with a lot of pomp and circumstance. Verse 24, Festus stands up and says, King Agrippa and all you gentlemen here present with us, you see this man about whom all the people of the Jews appealed to me, both at Jerusalem and here, loudly declaring that he ought to not to live any longer. But I found that he has committed nothing worthy of death. And since he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to send him. You'll notice there in verse 25, I found that he has committed nothing worthy of death. Back in chapter 23, verse 29, Commander Lysias is writing a letter to Felix as he sends Paul from Jerusalem to Caesarea. And look in verse 29, Lysias is writing a letter. And in that letter, in verse 29, it says, I found him to be accused over questions of their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. So ruler number one, who could have set him free and who believed Paul didn't do anything worthy of death or imprisonment, was Commander Lysias, but he didn't set him free. If we go to chapter 24, verses 26 and verse 27, again, verse 27, after 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. Wishing to do the Jews a favor, he kept Paul imprisoned. Ruler number two, Felix, who found nothing worthy of Paul being imprisoned, wouldn't let him go and then still incarcerated him unjustly. And now in chapter 25, verse 25, the next commander, the next governor, Festus, says that I did not find anything worthy of death. Governor number three, or leader number three, who could have let Paul go, didn't let him go. In fact, if we skip ahead to chapter 26 and verse 30 and 31, you'll find it says that King Agrippa stood up, and the governor and Bernice and those who were sitting with them. And when they had gone aside, they began to talk with one another. So who's talking? The King Agrippa, Governor Festus, Bernice, and those who were sitting with them. When they had gone aside, they began to talk to one another, saying, this man is not doing anything worthy of death or imprisonment. So ruler number four, who found that Paul had done nothing wrong, worthy of death or imprisonment, still refused to give him justice. Verse 25, back in chapter 25, verse 25 again, I found that he has done nothing worthy of death. But since he has appealed to the emperor, I had decided to send him. Look at verse 26. This is so incredible. Yet I have nothing definite to write about him to my Lord. Therefore, I have brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after the investigation has taken place, I might have something to write. For it seems absurd to me in sending a prisoner not to indicate also the charges against him. You know what Festus is saying? How can I send Paul to Caesar when I can't even articulate the charges against him? How foolish will I look if I write to the emperor and I can't even tell him what the charges are? And yet, Festus, like Felix before him, like Lysias the commander before him, and like King Agrippa after him, refuse to let Paul go. What can we learn from this story? I got a couple of things in your notes there. Number one, being right does not guarantee justice. Being godly, being innocent, being biblical does not guarantee justice. Especially if you're a follower of Christ. Let's go back a couple of books to the left, would you? Let's go back to the book of Matthew. I'm sorry, let's go back one book first. Let's go to John chapter 15. If you're in Acts, go to the left, just one book, John chapter 15, verses 18 to 21. Jesus is speaking, and look what he says. If the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were in the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, because of this the world hates you. Jesus has made it clear from the beginning of time that people throughout every century are going to despise him. And certainly over the last 2,000 years, we have seen that this has come true. Throughout the centuries, in many occasions, in many cultures, Jesus has become accursed. And if we are followers of Jesus, then some of that wrath is going to be spilt over onto us. Paul was innocent and over a period of 2 years had four people in charge that could have set him free, but all refused to do so. Jesus goes on, verse 20. Remember the word that I said to you, a slave is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also. But all these things they will do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know the one who sent me. You'll see what he says there? A slave is not greater than his master. If Jesus is my master and I am his servant, then why would I get out of some of the difficulties that he experienced? I'm not greater than he, am I? Am I so special that I get to be free from some of the difficulties that Jesus faced? The answer is no. If people ridicule Jesus, if people mocked him, and I am an open follower of Jesus, then I shouldn't be surprised that even though we're innocent, even though we're right, even though you might be living godly in this particular circumstance, there might be episodes in our life where justice is not served. And as I look at the landscape of America, I think we're going to need to be prepared to face injustices because we are followers of Christ and we stand what he stands for. Now, sometimes we make stupid decisions and we do silly things and we pay the consequences and we try to say, well, they're doing that to me because I'm a follower of Jesus, when they're doing that to you because you didn't pay your taxes. But even though we live godly, you may still end up getting divorced. Even though you live godly, you still may not get that promotion at work. Even though you live godly, you might be accused or charged with something that you're innocent of. Just because we're godly doesn't mean we always are guaranteed justice. That's why it's so important to remember that true justice is not going to happen to us until we see Jesus in heaven. That's our home. This is a place we're just passing through. So if you're going through something right now, a difficulty in your life that wasn't the result of your choice or your decision or your wrongdoing, but you still are not receiving justice, just understand that you're not alone. That it happens to many people. But on the other hand, what's so interesting, not what I do here. Fire me back up there, will you? I don't know what button I pushed wrong here. Thank you. I'll stop pushing them. Number two, don't be afraid to use our judicial system. It's God's institution. I put down there in my notes, and you can write it down, Romans chapter 13, 1 through 5, that God has established governments to persecute evil and to reward good. And I know that there may be a fear of our judicial system when it comes to getting justice, but it is God's institution. And so if you find yourself in a situation where you need to go to court to defend yourself or go to court to get what your personal rights deserve, let me encourage you, it's still God's institution in our land, in our time. I appreciate that Paul was not only a strong follower of Jesus, but a strong citizen. And he wasn't afraid to use the system that was in place in his time and in his area to protect his personal rights. And you know, in our place, in this time, our judicial system is there to protect our rights and to defend ourselves. So let me encourage you, if you need be, don't be afraid to use our judicial system. I have walked through our judicial system with many families in our church over the last 20-something years that I've been the pastor. And in almost every situation, the end result is just and fair. It gets all crazy and hairy at the beginning, because all things are slapped to the wall and all kinds of accusations and fears are flying around. But as the process works itself out, I have seen for the vast majority of the time, justice and fairness prevail. And it's God's institution. And our founding fathers put in a pretty good system of getting justice for us as American citizens. So don't be afraid to use the judicial system. And then finally, number three, remember that the providence of God is active among human circumstances. From Paul's perspective, 2 years have been wasted in Caesarea. Remember, Paul went on three missionary expeditions. Each of those missionary expeditions, thousands of people came to know Jesus. They lasted between 2 to 3 or 4 years max. And now Paul's been sitting in a jail cell for 2 years thinking, wow, I could have gone on expedition number 4 in the time that I've been incarcerated. But God knew what he was doing. And God knew exactly where Paul needed to be in that particular place, in that particular time. And God's providential handiwork continues to function within human circumstances, just like it did in Paul's day, in your and my day today. Just because I can't see how God is at work behind the scenes doesn't mean that God is not at work. And one of the things that gets us through the difficulties of life and the unfairness that we sometimes experience and the injustices that sometimes prevail is we've got to understand that God's providential hand is still working in human circumstances. Let's get down to a real current situation. Whatever happens this November, God's providential hand is still active in human circumstances. That's our hope. That's our peace. So if you're going through difficulties now, if you're going through hardships, if you're facing an unjust or unjust circumstance, don't forget that God is working. And ask Him to let you see it and to let you be a part of it. Because if we think that we're just sitting in this circumstance all on our own, we become lonely, we become isolated, we become fearful. When we've got to remember that God's hand is always working in our lives. Amen? So Paul had to have that assurance. Sitting in jail for 2 years, three guys could have freed him, and they all catered to the favor of the Jewish leaders instead of pronouncing justice in the circumstance. And Paul felt it was unfair and it was undeserved. And sometimes I know that's how we feel as well. Let's stand together and pray. Our gracious God in heaven, thank you that you love us so much. Thank you that as we look through these defenses of Paul, we find that he remained steadfast. But I'm sure in the darkness of night, he wondered about what you were up to. He wondered why he had to stay here for 2 years. Why he was not being released when no charges could be proven. And Lord, sometimes we feel like life isn't fair. Sometimes we face unjust circumstances. But Lord, as Paul trusted in you, may we trust in you as well. Thank you for your goodness to us. In Jesus' name, amen.